get our chronological thinking somewhat situated here. We have already covered the Pentateuch, as you know, and this period of time really covered from about 2000 B.C. down to 1400. Now, I use the early date for the Exodus. There is a lot of a good argument on the side of a late date, and there's still a lot of indecision and uncertainty about the date of the Exodus. But using the earlier date, which is a more traditional date of 1400, and then the date of David, about 1000 B.C., you can see then that we are now in a period of time which, as a maximum, has 400 years. And it may be as little as 250 or 60 years. But in that period, we've got Joshua, the period of the judges, the life of Samuel, and the life of Saul. And so you see that there's a great deal of history condensed into this short period of time. The same period of time prior to that, the period of the Israelites in Egypt, is of course almost the same period of time, and it told us almost nothing of that period. So we have a great bit more detail in the period that we're in now. And we just completed yesterday the period of Joshua, which is immediately after the Exodus, and would come, say, somewhere down around 1300, sometime in the 1300s. And as soon as Joshua died, then we begin in what we now know as the period of the judges. Now, the only assumption that we can make as we calculate the various cycles of the periods of the judges, because they total 410 years of themselves, the only assumption that we can make is that there must be an overlapping here, and that in these cycles of the periods of the various judges, there must have been one judge here and another judge elsewhere in Israel simultaneously. If you added all of the periods of the judges end to end, it would extend over the bounds of this, and it can't, because the judges itself has to be condensed within a period less than this 400 years. Now, this is the maximum time you can have. And so, obviously, there must be overlapping. It's the only conceivable solution to that problem. Now, today, we will look at the period of the judges. And as you can see, the book of Judges divides itself into two sections, much as we saw Joshua divided into two sections. Not quite as evenly divided in terms of chapters. The first 16 chapters are concerned with the cycles of history that we shall note and study somewhat this morning. And then the latter part of the book of Judges, chapter 17 to the end, deal with two examples of conditions in Israel in these times. First of all, then, the cycles of the history. The first thing that concerns us in the book of Judges here is the aftermath of Joshua, that period when the people of Israel were still living in the afterglow of Joshua and his generation. You note that it says here, after the death of Joshua, the children of Israel began to ask, "Who shall go up for us first against the Canaanites?" And we're told that the Lord directed that Judah, and Judah with Simeon, should go and should make certain conquests. Now, this would make clear the fact that the job of conquest and vanquishing the enemy was not completed at the death of Joshua. He had apparently led the armies to cover the general area of what was to be Israel, and that they had certainly made conquests, but there were isolated cities and sections within Canaan that still had to be dealt with. And we see then a people that are still quite obedient to God, quite open to the will of God. They turn to God and ask, "Who shall go up?" They seek the leading of God. And this whole generation is still the leftovers, so to speak, of the generation that knew Joshua, and even some who may have known Moses. And we have the account, for instance, in verse 12 of Caleb. And Othniel who was a nephew of Caleb, all having to do with some of these early conquests after the time of Joshua. Then we're told in the latter part of chapter 1 that many of the tribes failed to drive out the inhabitants. We note in verse 27, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Bethshan. This means some of the towns in the area of Manasseh were left unconquered. And then there's a whole list similar to this. Ephraim, Zebulun, Asher, Naphtali. The rest of the chapter mentions one tribe after another that failed to press out some of the people that were still there of the Canaanites. And verse 28 gives us some insight into what they were actually doing in these days. It says that when Israel waxed strong, and evidently they were stronger than any of the other inhabitants of Canaan at this time, they put the Canaanites to task work and did not utterly drive them out. You remember in Joshua chapter 9 that Joshua and the elders with him made a bargain with the men of Gibeon and spared them and made them hewers of wood and drawers of water. Now this same thing then seems to have been repeated. And I pointed out then that that was probably the most serious danger of what Joshua and the men did in making that treaty with the Gibeonites. He gave the people the taste of the idea of slavery. Well, we can have cheap labor. We can have them do all of the manual labor. And apparently the idea caught on and spread so that in every tribe there were cities and peoples who were used as slave labor. But you see, in doing this, the Canaanites continued to live and continued to worship their gods, and Israel became increasingly susceptible to paganism. We see this in chapter 2, where we're reminded that God once again warned the people, saying, "You shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land, but you have not hearkened to my voice. Wherefore, I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they will be as thorns in your sides, and their gods a snare." Now, we can see also something of the spiritual sensitivity of the people of this time. Though they allowed the Canaanites to live, they could still face their sins and weep. We see this in verse 4. They repented of their sins, and this is encouraging about that era. And so we're told in summary, in verse 7, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work the Lord did. But when Joshua died, in verse 10, also that generation, that is, that immediately followed Joshua and who had known him, when they all died, were gathered to their fathers, which is a figurative term for death. Then there arose another generation after them that knew not the Lord, nor yet the work which he had wrought for Israel. And I think that this second part of verse 10 of chapter 2 gives to us a considerable insight into the problem that began to develop. Apparently, the generation that lived after Joshua failed in respect to God's exhortation in Deuteronomy 6 because their children didn't know about God. They did not know the mighty works of God. Somehow, in their busyness in occupying the land and building houses and planting gardens and vineyards, the people must have neglected the duty, the solemn duty of parents. And so a whole generation grew up that didn't know the Lord. Now, this kind of sad story has been repeated over and over in the history of the church. There'll be a dedicated generation that's experienced great revival, but somehow they don't pass that on to their children, and their children begin to grow up not knowing the Lord at all, or at least not knowing him in the richness and fullness that their parents knew him. This is apparently what happened here. And so we see a cycle of sorts that was repeated over and over in the period of Judges begins to be delineated here for us. The cycle consisted of four parts. First of all, sin on the part of the people. Verse 11, the children of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baalim, forsook the Lord, followed other gods. Then, the second part of the cycle, verse 14, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of spoilers. God's judgment because they departed from him. The third part of the cycle, the distress of the people. The latter part of verse 15, the people were sore distressed. And many times we're told that they cried out to the Lord. And then the fourth part of the cycle, verse 16, the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those that despoiled them. God's response to their cries of distress by sending a judge to save them. And then verse 17 shows the cycle beginning all over again. Yet they hearkened not to their judges, played the harlot after other gods. So we see the cycle, and this is the pattern of the cycle that we're given here in chapter 2. And we shall see this cycle repeated many times in the history of Israel in these days. So God says in chapter 3 that he would leave certain nations among the Canaanites to be thorns in the flesh to test and try his people. And he mentioned specifically the five cities of the Philistines, the Canaanites, Sidonians, these are the coastal peoples, and the peoples inland, the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, and so forth. And they were left to prove Israel, as verse 4 says. In other words, they were left here as a testing of the faithfulness of God's people. And so we begin in chapter 3, verse 7, with the cycles themselves. And I've listed seven of the cycles here for you, some of the more major cycles. There apparently were others, but they're not elaborated upon. And each of these cycles has these same characteristics that I've pointed out to you. The first phase of it, the sin of the people. The second phase, the judgment of God. The third phase, the distress and cry of the people. The fourth phase, the raising up of a judge to deliver the people. We shall see this then in the cycles. We see it here in the first cycle, which I've called the Mesopotamia-Othniel cycle. And I call it that mainly because the name first given will be the name of the country that God uses particularly to trouble the people. And then the second name is the judge that God raises up to deliver the people. And that's true of each of these seven cycles that I've given here. So it is here. The people did evil in God's sight. Verse 8, the anger of the Lord was kindled, and he raised up Mesopotamia. Verse 9, the children of Israel cried to the Lord. Third part of the cycle. And then also in verse 9, the Lord raised up a savior to the children of Israel, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. So he'd been a nephew of Caleb himself, was the first of the judges. So you see the cycle running here true to form. Sin, judgment, an outcry of the people for help, and God raising up a judge. And we note in verse 10, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. This is also a characteristic phrase to be found in the book of Judges. It would seem then that God, in raising up the judges, endowed them with special gifts through his Spirit that came upon them. And Othniel then reigned as judge for some 40 years, and the people had peace during that time. Then we come to the second cycle, also in chapter 3. I call the Moab-Ehud cycle. Again, the people do evil, and God strengthened Moab and the king of Moab, Eglon. This is a rather grimy story here. The people cry out because of the persecution, and God raises up Ehud, who takes it upon himself to go into the king Eglon, and he has a sword hidden as he enters in, and while he's alone with the king, he plunges the sword into him, and it goes all the way through his body. And since they were in an upper room in a quiet place, he's able to make his escape and rally the people of Israel, telling them the king of Moab is dead. And the people rally and smite Moab, and we're told in verse 30 that Moab was subdued for a period of time. Then the third cycle is really hardly a cycle here. It's a case of the Philistines' power at one time and Shamgar being raised up as a judge, all in verse 31. Then the next major cycle we come to is in chapter 4. The cycle here involves the land of Canaan, which was raised up by God to punish the people, and Deborah, who was a prophetess in Israel at that time, who was raised up when the people cried out. And we're told about Deborah beginning with verse 4. She judged Israel during this time, and she called on Barak, who was a warrior in Israel, to lead the people against the king of Canaan, one of the Canaanite kingdoms. And Barak hesitated. In verse 8 he said, well, I will go if you'll go with me. In other words, he was not willing to go on his own and fight against these enemies. He had to be assured that God was on his side, and the only way he knew to be sure was to request that Deborah, the prophetess, go with him. Now, she said she would go, but she said, because you've been unwilling to do this, the Lord will sell Sisera, that is the enemy, into the hands of a woman. So we're told in the latter part of chapter 4 of this interesting account of Sisera and Barak fighting, and Sisera is put to rout, and he flees from Barak that day. And as he flees, he comes to the tent of a certain woman, and he asks to rest in her tent. Apparently, he considers her a friendly person. In the past, they've been friendly. And he rests, and while he rests, he takes a tent peg and drives it through his head. And so he's very dead that day. Then chapter 5 is a record, a song of Deborah, which is written in celebration of this great victory. And it's considered as one of the earliest examples of Hebrew poetry, because it was written quite early in the time of Israel's history. It's a rather remarkable account, and it gives to us a considerable amount of detail of what happened, but also some general knowledge of the people and their faith. The tribes are here mentioned by name, several of them are. The praise of God, God came down and did these things, gave the victory. The latter part of it in particular is interesting. It, in verse 24, begins to praise this woman who had killed Sisera. Blessed above women shall Jael be, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Blessed shall she be above women in the tent. He asked water, she gave him milk. She brought him butter in a lordly dish. She put her hand to the tent pin and her right hand to the workman's hammer. Now here we have the parallelism that Hebrew poetry is known for, saying one line and then following it with another similar line. For instance, she put her hand to the tent pin, her right hand to the workman's hammer. A kind of parallelism here, painting the picture of her getting ready to drive the tin in. With a hammer, she smote Sisera, she smote through his head. Yea, she pierced and struck through his temples. At her feet he bowed, he fell, he lay. At her feet he bowed, he fell. Where he bowed, there he fell down dead. The idea being that he was quite dead at the end of this episode. The latter part is very picturesque. Now the scene shifts to the mother of Sisera. She's waiting for her son to return in victory. And she asks, as she looks out the window, why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the wheels of his chariot? Her wise ladies answer, and she herself said, have they not divided the spoil? In other words, the only logical explanation for his delay is that they're out there busily dividing the spoil. But note the way that this spoil is described here. To Sisera, spoil of dyed garments, the spoil of dyed garments embroidered, of dyed garments embroidered on both sides, on the necks of the spoil. The word dyed garments is used here three times, and suggests perhaps the idea of being dyed with his own blood. The poetess here is expressing here, in picturesque terms, the death of this man, and she's waiting for her, his mother's waiting for him to bring home these beautifully dyed garments. And what the poetess is saying here, the prophetess is saying, is they'll be dyed all right in his own blood. So let all the enemies perish, O Lord. But let them that love him be as the sun when he goeth forth in his might. Then in chapter 6 we have the familiar cycle. It really is several chapters long here, of the Midianites and Gideon, the famous hero of Israel. Gideon here is first described as just a very humble man. And we have again the cycle of the distress of the people. And finally, when the people cry out, the Lord responds by raising up Gideon. We're told of this particularly beginning in verse 11. His father's name is Joash, and his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the wine press. Suddenly the angel of the Lord appeared, and the Lord reassured him of God's presence. The Lord is with thee. Here again that phrase we've seen so often. Now, the response of Gideon was, well, if the Lord's with us, then why are we suffering like we are? Here the Midianites are dominating us. We are slaves. How can you say God's with us? So God gives a commission. Go in your might and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you? Now, immediately we see Gideon protest, as we'd seen Moses protest earlier. Who am I? How can I do this? He says, my family is the poorest. I'm the very least. Surely you're not going to choose me. And God's answer again, as he said to Moses in verse 16, surely I will be with thee. We see God over and over encouraging those he calls by this reassuring promise, I will be with you. Now then, the first command that's given to Gideon is to go in and to tear down the altars of Baal. And he does this at night. When in the morning it's discovered that Gideon had done this thing, the people are ready to stone him. They want to kill him. But his father himself, who apparently was a Baal worshiper, nevertheless defends his son. He says in verse 31, will you contend for Baal, or will you save him? He that will contend for him, let him be put to death. If he be a god, let him contend for himself. In other words, the father said, all right, if Baal really is God, then let him punish my son. Now again in verse 34, this familiar phrase, the Spirit of the Lord came on Gideon, as we've seen already with others of the judges, so with Gideon. He has the Spirit of the Lord giving him strength. He rallies the people together to fight against Midian. Now in verse 36, we have the interesting episode here of Gideon and the fleece which he laid out. Now know what he says. If thou wilt save Israel by my hand, as thou hast spoken. In other words, you've already said you would, but now if you really mean it, behold, I put out a fleece of wool. If there be dew on the fleece only, and it be dry on the ground, then I'll know that you'll save Israel by my hand. And it was so. In the morning he rose up, and it was like he said. Now he asked for a second test in verse 39. Let not thine anger be kindled against me. Let me make trial again. And he then said just the opposite. Let it be dry only on the fleece and dew on the ground around. So God did just that night. Now, this whole episode of Gideon and the fleece should be understood in the context in which it occurred. And I want you to note, God had already told him exactly what he was going to do. Furthermore, Gideon knew exactly what God had said. God had said, I'm going to deliver Israel by your hand. And Gideon said, now if you're really going to do this, if you really mean what you said, then you respond by showing it in this particular sign that you do for me. And what I'm saying is this, the context of Gideon's laying out the fleece was not a context of faith, nor was it a context of discovering what the will of God was. It was a context of trying to make God prove that he really meant what he had said, which is far from an act of faith. Now, it really was an act of disbelief. Gideon was not able to accept God at his word. He had to have a sign. And a sign is never in Scripture something for the strong in faith, but for the weak in faith. A sign is required because people don't have enough faith to believe in the Word of God. And so this was not really, I mean, he had to have some visible, concrete sign there that God really meant what he said. I'm saying all of this because you've probably heard and maybe even used the term, I'm going to lay out the fleece. In the first place, very few of us have ever laid out a fleece. And that's all that the Scripture could warrant in the beginning. Secondly, it's not an act of faith. It's an act of disbelief. You can't take God at His word. You got to have a sign. That's not a sign. It's not a sign of strong faith, but of weakness. And the thing that was done here then was not in any way complimentary of the great faith of Gideon, but showed how very weak his faith really was. Now, God then was determined, according to chapter 7, God was determined that He would show that this delivery would be by God's power and not by man at all. And so when the masses were gathered around, He said, "There are too many. Tell all of those that are fearful and trembling to go back." So in verse 3, He does this. And still there were 10,000. God said, "There's still too many." So in verse 5, He says, "Now everyone that laps of the water with his tongue when they go down to drink, as a dog laps, him set by himself, and likewise everyone that bows down on his knees to drink." Now, this was a means of separating the people. And some 300 that lapped were set aside, and the rest were sent home. Now, a lot of people have tried to make a point here that those that lapped in a particular way, the 300, showed that they were ready to fight, and they proved that they were the better warriors. I'm not at all sure, though, that this is the point. Because what God wanted was the least number. God wanted it made manifest that He was the one that was going to bring the victory, and not the strong numbers. And God was interested in reducing the numbers to the fewest possible. Really, His victory was His victory. It wasn't even by the hand of these 300, but it was really altogether by God Himself, as we shall see. Now, we're told then that to reassure Gideon even more, he and a fellow went down into the camp of the Midianites and heard two men talking about a dream in which they saw this great loaf of bread rolling down and destroying the camp. And they therefore became convinced that God was going to deliver the Midianites into their hands. Now they took pictures, I'm sure you're familiar with the story, and they blew their trumpets. But note verse 22. They blew the 300 trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow. When they blew the trumpets, God somehow intervened and so utterly confused and excited the thinking of the Midianites that they began to fight and kill one another. And ultimately, the victory was God's victory, as we see here. Now Gideon and his men begin to pursue after these other peoples that are fleeing now. Chapter 8 shows us something of the wisdom of the man Gideon. The men of Ephraim somehow were not involved, and they felt neglected. And they rebuked Gideon for not calling on them. We're told in chapter 8, verse 1, they did chide with him sharply. Now, note Gideon's answer. What an answer of wisdom and diplomacy. "What have I now done in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God hath delivered into your hand the princes of Midian. And what was I able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger was abated. A very diplomatic answer. In other words, the Ephraimites were mad because they had fought the Midianites and had not involved them. Therefore, they weren't going to be able to get any of the booty. And his response was, "Well, look, now what I've done is nothing compared to you people. You're so much greater than I am. Me and my humble men here, we're not much of anything, and we're not going to get much of a prize. Look at how much you have." And he flattered them in such a way that they were perfectly satisfied. Then we have the strange events that follow the victory. In verse 23, first of all, the people approach into Gideon and try to make him king over all Israel. They say in verse 22, "Gideon, rule over us." And his response, which is a good one, "I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." He recognizes that it's improper for them to seek a king at this point, that God is their king and he should be the one whom they would honor. He hearkens all the way back to Exodus 15, and seek to give glory to God. He is their king. Yet right after this, in verse 27, we're told that Gideon took some of the jewels that they gave him that day. He made an ephod, put it in his city, and all Israel played the harlot after it there, and it became a snare unto Gideon and his house. He made something unwarranted. He made an object of worship, and the people and himself stumbled. And so Gideon ends up rather unhappily for us. Though he did many things that we can commend, refusing to be king and leading the men in battle, yet he ended up causing Israel to stumble spiritually. He had quite a family. Verse 30 tells us he had 70 sons. And he lived to a good old age and died. Then we see the people begin to turn away from God again after Gideon's death. We're told here in chapter 9 the interesting episode of an internal struggle between Abimelech, one of the sons of Jerubbaal, or the other name for Gideon. Jerubbaal was one of the names for Gideon. A conflict between Abimelech and the other son. And it happens that Abimelech gets power behind him, and he's able to destroy all of the rest of the sons of Gideon except one son, Jotham, who escapes. The people make Abimelech king. You remember Gideon, his father, refused to be king, but verse 6 tells us that they did make Abimelech, his son, a king. Now this was not over all of Israel really, but over certain tribes. Jotham, the wronged son, the only surviving son of the 70, rebukes publicly Abimelech for what he has done and the people for allowing him to do it. And then he has to flee. But he does not flee until he brings a curse both on Abimelech and on the people who have supported him at Shechem. In verse 20, we see that curse. Let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem. And then let fire come out from the men of Shechem and devour Abimelech. So the rest of the chapter tells us of the fulfillment of that curse. That in reality, Abimelech and these people of Shechem who had allied here together fall out, fight one another, and in the end kill one another. The next cycle, the cycle of the enemy being raised up, Ammon, and Jephthah, the judge that was raised up to deliver them, begins in chapter 10, verse 6. And it's a cycle that also has a real sadness to it. We read in verse 10, the people cried unto the Lord and said, we have sinned. And the Lord rebukes them because of their failure to follow him, and says that they should look to someone else to deliver them, because after all they've turned from God. But the people continue to cry out. And then we're told in chapter 11 that God raised up Jephthah. And Jephthah, we're told, was a son who had been cast out by his own family because he was not a full son in the family. He was the son of a harlot, and he was cast out by his brothers. But when they got in trouble and needed deliverance, they turned to Jephthah because he was a mighty man. So we're told in chapter 11 that he agrees to fight for Israel, provided the people will make him their head. So he goes out and he arranges to fight with Ammon. Chapter 11 gives us the account of this. Then note verse 29. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. Like the other judges, he too is assured of God's presence and the Spirit of the Lord. Now he moves out. He's assured of victory here. He goes out in the assumption that he'll conquer. And yet, in verse 30, we see him do something quite strange. He vows a vow to the Lord and says, if you will indeed deliver the children of Ammon into my hand, then it will be that whatsoever comes forth from the doors of my house to meet me when I return, it will be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Why he did this, we're not told. Apparently he wanted some extra insurance. Just like Gideon had to have his sign, now Jephthah, in a way, is bribing God, saying, now, if you'll really give me the victory, here again we see the indications of weakness and faith. If you'll really give me the victory, then I'll offer up as a sacrifice whatever comes out of my house to greet me when I return. Now, what he expected to come out of his house, I don't know. A sheep, a goat, a cow, what? We don't know. But his daughter came out. And the rest of chapter 11 is the sad record of his offering up his daughter as a sacrifice. The only time that we have a record such as this in the history, nowhere do we find that God ever demanded or requested. In fact, he forbade such sacrifices of children in the Pentateuch itself. The only parallel situation would be, of course, the events in Genesis 22, where God commanded Abraham to offer Isaac. But at that time, it was God who took the initiative and God who intervened so that it could not be carried out. Here, it was an act of disbelief on Jephthah's part that made him make such a vow in the first place. Since the Spirit of God had come on him as he had on the other deliverers, there was no reason for him to make such a vow. It apparently was an attempt to get extra insurance, even to bribe God. And as a result, it ended up in a very miserable situation for him and his family and in the history of Israel. Then chapter 13 is the last of the cycles that we have recorded. It begins in 13 and goes through 16. It's that very familiar cycle of Samson himself. Samson, too, does not come across as a great man of faith. There are many things about him that leave us unhappy. Verse 25 of chapter 13 again shows that the Spirit of the Lord began to move in him. That is, that like the other judges, the Spirit of God came on him and gave him extra wisdom and strength. But he had real spiritual weaknesses. In chapter 14, verse 2, for instance, we're told that he had a desire to marry one of the Philistine girls, something that God had strictly forbidden. We have the account of his marriage to her and then of his riddle that he told. I won't go into the details. Much of this is quite familiar to you. How in anger after he was tricked by these so-called friends of his, in verse 14 of chapter 15, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily on him and he took a jawbone of an ass and smote 1,000 men. He was quite a man, and he was one of the means by which God delivered his people in the times of distress. Chapter 16 begins the end of the story of Samson. It tells about his love of a woman, another Canaanite, and her name was Delilah. We read there the familiar story of how she finally got him to tell her the secret of his strength, that he was a Nazarite, and that if he cut his hair, then his strength would go from him. So she cut his hair, and he is captured by the Philistines, as you, I'm sure, well remember. And for some time, he's in the prison house, we're told in verse 21 of chapter 16, grinding in the prison house, apparently like a beast of burden, grinding the grain as he pulls the grinder round and round. And gradually his hair grows back, and on a certain day when he's tied at the temple of the Philistines and they're up on top of the roof enjoying and living up their sinful acts, he, with his last strength, pulls a house down and destroys thousands of them in one day. Now, he is the last of the judges, and he's typical of the judges. I mean, the last of the judges recorded in the book of Judges, and he's typical of the judges. If we look at the whole period, look at all of these cycles, what we really see here is a period of many heroes, but no real spiritual leaders. We see men who could do some mighty feats, and the stories of them are hero stories. They were men of faith. Hebrews 11, enlisting great men of faith, mentioned several of the judges by name. They were men who had faith in God, and God used them. But they were never a spiritual inspiration to the people. They were nothing like Moses, nothing like Joshua, nothing like Samuel, who was to come later. Far short in their stature of any of these. For the most part, we see the leadership is weak, mainly because the people themselves and the whole spiritual climate of that day was a weak one. The period of the judges can rightly be called the Dark Ages of the Old Testament Israel. And these Dark Ages are even more emphasized in the two stories that were told in the latter part of the book of Judges. And the first of these has to do with a man named Micah and the Danites, the people of Dan, the tribe of Dan. And this is in chapters 17 and 18. Apparently Micah had stolen some of his mother's silver, and he finally confessed to it. What was the occasion of his confession, we don't know, but he finally owned up to it, we're told, and said, "Behold, the silver is with me, I took it." Well, his mother's so pleased that he turned the silver back to her that she dedicated the silver, and they made a graven image. Now, this gives you some idea of the spiritual state in those days. Here they are taking silver and making an image in diametrically opposition to the will of God. We'll see in these chapters virtually all of the Ten Commandments are broken by God's people during this time. Probably the best description of this time is given in a kind of parenthesis here that we find in this latter part of the book of Judges. Both here in 17 verse 6 and in chapter 21, chapter 25, the very last verse of the book of Judges, we have the same phrase. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now this is a kind of parenthesis for all that's going to happen. God was truly the king of God's people. But as far as the people themselves were concerned, they were not living under the kingship of God. They had rejected his will and his law. You remember that Exodus 15:18 told them that the Lord is king? You remember that Gideon had reminded them in Judges 8:24 that God was king? But as far as the people themselves were concerned, he was not king, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. This is the sad commentary that's repeated in the book of Judges for us. Now here we're given the account then of the man Micah and the God that he made, the graven images. We're told in verse 5 that he set up a house of God and he made one of his sons to be priest. Every bit of this in clear violation of the will of God. Now it happens then that there came out of Bethlehem, Judah, a Levite, and this Levite came and dwelt there with him. And when he found out that he had a Levite to be his priest, he really felt like he was well off. And we're told then in verse 13, "Then Micah said, Now I know that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest." Nowhere does Scripture ever suggest that a Levite was to be a private priest. That is, that he was to serve one household. This was again a clear violation of the law of Moses. And we see again how completely ignorant of God's will and God's law the people were in these days. Chapter 18 tells us of the people of Dan looking for their inheritance. Apparently, at least some members of the tribe of Dan had not yet found their resting place. They were still looking for their inheritance. And as they were wandering about, they happened to pass by the city of Micah. And they learned that he had this priest and these gods, graven images. So chapter 18 tells us that they take these things and they tell the priest, "Now, would you rather be priest to one man or a whole tribe?" And naturally, he'd rather be priest to a whole tribe. So he goes along, and all of this happens while Micah's away. Micah comes and he tries to get back what has been stolen by the children of Dan. And they say, "Well, if you want to live, you'll forget about it." And Micah gets the message and he drops the whole thing. But all of this, you see, is a portrait of the spiritual state in those days. Imagine a state in God's people where they can make graven images and set up priests according to their own will. The whole thing, all out of accord with the express will of God. Verse 30 of chapter 18 is quite interesting. The children of Dan set up for themselves the graven image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, he and his sons were priests of the tribe of the Danites, which would seem to indicate that perhaps then this priest, who was unnamed up until this point, this priest that they have captured and taken to be their private priest, was a direct descendant of Moses. And what a sad story that is, to realize that this one who is a grandson of Moses now becomes a private priest and ministers to idols. It really says something about the power of Satan to move in so quickly in the midst of God's people and to corrupt their thinking so thoroughly. Now the last story, chapter 19 through 21, tells another rather sordid story. The Levite and the Benjaminites, again a Levite is involved, and he married a certain concubine, he had a concubine, also out of Bethlehem. Note that both of these stories are located in one sense in Bethlehem. Well, his concubine fled from him and went back to her father in Bethlehem. He went down there, he got her, and he brought her back with him. And so chapter 19 tells of his journey back. We're told as he passed on his way back home, went by Jebus, that's Jerusalem, and his servant suggested to him that they might stay there that night. But he said, no, I'm not going to stay with these pagans. I'll go stay with some of the Israelites. We'll pass over to Gibeah where there are people of Israel. So he came to Gibeah, we're told in verse 15, and there was nobody there to take him in. The Gibeonites were hostile. We're reminded somewhat of Sodom and Gomorrah here in the attitude of the people of Gibeah. And so these Benjaminites, among whom he was dwelling here, who were hostile and would not welcome him, while he was deciding what to do, there was a stranger that came by in verse 16, not a citizen of Gibeah, but living there and having a house there. And he invited the Levite in. It's interesting the parallelism here between this and some of the episodes such as Sodom and Gomorrah. Even something of a similarity with the Good Samaritan account, because here we find this man who wouldn't be expected to be hospitable, and those that should have been hospitable were not. So the stranger takes him into his house. Then in verse 22, while they were enjoying their company together, the men of the city, base fellows, came and demanded that he be brought out. Well, we have the Sodom and Gomorrah story all over again. Here we have this kind host, like Lot, not wanting to send out his guest, offering to send out his own daughter in verse 24. Finally, they take the concubine, the men do, of the city, and they lay with her all night and abused her all night long. In the morning, when the Levite was ready to go, he found his concubine dead at the door. His response to this was to take her and to cut her up into little pieces and send her out all the way through the land, warning the people that such a terrible, atrocious thing has been done and it must be revenged. So we have the account then in chapter 20 and 21 of the people of Israel gathering together and going against the tribe of Benjamin. They fight the tribe of Benjamin and virtually destroy it. And then they cry to God, why has this happened? Why has one tribe been wiped out? And God has apparently punished them because of the sin of Benjamin. And so the people spared just a few of the Benjaminites. I'm just condensing here to conclude this. They spare a few of the male Benjaminites, and they manage to get wives for them. And so the Benjaminites are not totally wiped out, but from this time on, they never are a strong tribe. From this time on, Benjamin is one of the weakest tribes all the way through the rest of the history of Israel. Now, I have a few concluding remarks that I'll say, if you'll allow me to just hold you just a moment here to point out these things. First of all, as we look at the whole period of the judges, we see that it's a period in which there is spiritual chaos. Almost every one of the commandments is recorded as having been broken. Dishonor of parents, stealing, making graven images, worshiping other gods, covetousness, killing, adultery, all of these things are repeated and perpetrated and mentioned here specifically in the book of Judges. What brought on this spiritual chaos? Probably the neglect of godly people to teach their children the will of God. You remember that God had ordained that the godly parents should teach their children God's word, meditate on it, exemplify it in their lives. Deuteronomy 6. We were told in Judges 2:10 that the people grew up, a whole generation grew up, who did not know the Lord. The only explanation I can find for that is that their parents, who knew the Lord, had not taught them. And this brought in a whole era of spiritual darkness and chaos that nearly did away with the whole people of Israel. But we'll see that there were exceptions, and that that's not the whole story of the period of Judges. And we'll meet again in about 10 minutes.